From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
West Oakland.
I live in San Leandro now.
Up Beach.
Coming up, we go out on a boat to investigate a complicated question. What's the water quality like in the Bay?
We get that question all the time when we pull into docks and they're always like, how's it going out there? Like, what's the water like?
Then we'll hear about life as a resident of one of San Francisco's few remaining residential hotels.
This is not where you want to die in a hotel like this, but you know what? I'm fine here.
And we'll look back at the birth of San Francisco's official city band, the Lesbian Gay Freedom Band.
Being older, the younger kids don't really realize how hard it was.
Testing the water and diving in deep. This is Cross Currents. Stay with us. Standing Rock protesters rejoiced on Sunday when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit needed by the Dakota Access Pipeline to drill under the Missouri River. Alternate routes will now be explored. Protesters caution that halting the pipeline is far from defeating it for good. The world is increasingly recognizing the challenge to protect clean water, which brings us to the very water that surrounds us here in the Bay Area. Let me introduce Austin Newsom.
Hi.
Austin is an Amtrak ticket agent at the Transbay Terminal downtown San Francisco.
Hi.
On his lunch breaks, he takes walks along the Embarcadero.
It's really nice, and people usually, when they're walking along the waterfront, for whatever reason, they have big smiles on their face. I think it makes people happy.
Austin got curious about what he was looking at, so he reached out to Hay Area, KALW's reporting project, and he asked
what the water quality of the bay is and who keeps track of that.
So KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston went out on a very loud boat to find him some answers.
Actually, there are people whose jobs are dedicated to answering that question. People like biologist Erica Najad.
We get that question all the time when we pull into docks and they're always like, how's it going out there? Like, what's the water like?
When I meet her on this big metal boat, the sun hasn't come up yet. We put on red life vests and then step into a makeshift lab. Everyone is unpacking test tubes, bottles, and funnels out of boxes before we leave the dock. Najad and a team at the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS, go out on this boat twice a month, measuring the water quality up and down the bay. They've been doing it for almost 50 years.
So we have this long historical data set, and it's always the same location.
On this boat, Najad and the team measure a variety of things in the water. Nutrients like ammonia and phosphate, salinity, temperature, and oxygen, and a handful of other parameters. At sunrise, the boat leaves the dock and motors out of the marina toward our first stop, just underneath the Dumbarton Bridge. There, the captain of the boat radios Najad on a walkie-talkie, tells her the location and how deep it is. She jots the info down, and the team starts to take their first samples.
Erica, are you set?
Here's how they do it. Najad lowers a large cylindrical metal tube into the water until it hits the bottom of the bay. This is the conductivity, temperature, and depth sensor, or CTD, and it's a pretty common tool in this line of work.
It's a really fancy set of sensors, and that little cable connects to it, and Erica stands here, and she'll control it, and she'll be able to see all of the things that we're measuring for, but in real time.
That's scientist Zephyr Sylvester, a volunteer on the boat. When Najad lowers the fancy CTD sensor into the water, Sylvester also collects water samples at the same spot for comparison to make sure they're getting the correct data.
It's so clear.
I know, the bottom sample at 24 was like crazy clear.
Sylvester takes the samples from the bottom of the bay and its surface and processes them in different ways for the different things they're measuring. First, she pours the water through filters inside the boat's lab.
The matter that is floating in the water will stick onto that filter, and all the filters have been pre-weighed. So then when they dry out, we can figure out how much is actually in the water.
Then she hands the water samples in brown, light-proof bottles to another scientist who pours the water through other filters.
So those ones, you can see they're all taped in black because they filter chlorophyll, and to measure the chlorophyll, you don't want any light to hit it.
Other water samples have chemicals added to them and will be analyzed later on. All of this takes fewer than 10 minutes. Once they're done, they move on to the next GPS station and repeat. They reach their last station between Angel Island and Alcatraz around lunchtime.
And the current is ripping.
They'll analyze all the samples in a lab and enter the data into a public online database with data collected 5 or 10 or 40 years before.
All of those things come together to give us a picture of how healthy the bay is.
Okay, but we still haven't really answered Austin's question. What's the water quality like in the bay?
It's hard to like kind of summarize this take-home answer.
That's because there isn't one. Water quality is a broad term.
There's so many different parameters that we measure, and half the time we're out here, we're very just focused on collecting the data and making sure we have good data.
There isn't one single thing you can measure that tells you if it's good or if it's bad overall. County agencies, they monitor drinking water. Other agencies look at swimming conditions. And the USGS team, the data they collect tell us a lot about phytoplankton. Now, these scientists know phytoplankton isn't the most charming of marine life.
Or if you tell people that you're a marine biologist, they think you've studied whales and dolphins. And so when you say phytoplankton, they kind of dull down and like, oh, like, and you're like, not that type of marine biologist.
But phytoplankton, basically microscopic marine plants, are food for a wide range of creatures, from whales to snails to shrimp, which is why they're the perfect thing to measure.
Without a good, healthy phytoplankton community, that the rest of the food chain would suffer.
But too many phytoplankton can be a bad thing. They'll cause algal blooms, which can poison fish, seals, birds, and even people. The San Francisco Bay hasn't had a big bloom, but everyone I talk to says it could happen soon. Nothing in the bay is constant. Just ask Jim Clern, the leader of the USGS water quality team.
San Francisco Bay is a place that is in a continual state of change.
Let's start with the good news.
Since the 1950s, we've cleaned up sewage that is discharged into the bay.
And also heavy metals.
We're talking about things like copper, silver, nickel, zinc.
From electronics and other industries. The South Bay was one of the most contaminated estuaries in the world.
And they were so high in the lower part of the South Bay that clams couldn't reproduce.
But treatment worked, and the clams are back. Now for some bad news, the things we still need to work on. The freshwater rivers that feed the bay aren't flowing at their full capacity. They're being diverted for agriculture and our lawns and showers. This is essentially creating a drought for the creatures that live in the bay. Another problem, some fish in the bay are still contaminated with dangerous chemicals like mercury and PCBs that travel up the food web.
And mercury and PCBs are more difficult water quality problems to solve.
They are legacy pollutants, meaning they've been around for a long, long time.
There are large quantities of mercury in the sediments of San Francisco Bay that were introduced during the gold mining era.
So how's the bay doing? He says it will be great.
After we can grow oysters and it's safe for us to eat them.
And then there are the things that aren't problems yet, but could be. That toxic algae I mentioned, or microplastics, plastic found in facial scrubs. And Clern says the only way to understand these potential problems, keep monitoring.
Each measurement that we make tells a different story. And all of those stories are the book about San Francisco Bay.
All the scientists studying the bay add to that book every time they gather data. But most of the time, Clern says, the public only gets to see the cover. When I meet Austin Newsom on one of his Embarcadero Bayside walks, we sit at a bench staring out at the bay, the cover of Clern's book. The water is blue and calm. There's someone kayaking in the distance.
It's just such a large, pretty bay.
Twice a month, Erica Najad and the USGS team cruise by this bench on their way back from taking samples. Heading back to the lab, working toward an answer to Austin's central question: how's water quality in the bay doing? The answer may never be simple, but right now, this is how Najad sums it up.
I would say it depends, but it's better than it used to be.
For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Angela Johnston is KALW's environment reporter. You can tell her what stories you think she ought to cover at environment@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This week, we're listening to the stories of residents of SROs, that's single-room occupancy buildings, or residential hotels. There are about 19,000 San Franciscans living in SROs today, but that number is scarce compared to 50 years ago. In the 60s and 70s, many of San Francisco's residential hotels were demolished when the city's high-rise financial district boomed into existence. By the end of the 70s, immigrant communities and low-wage workers who depended on the cheap dormitory-style housing organized against demolitions. The highest-profile protest was the I Hotel, where hundreds of activists camp out.
Both the International Hotel and its commercial tenants are subject to eviction at any time, day or night. This is the most critical stage of the struggle to save the International Hotel.
Eventually, the protesters were forcibly removed and arrested, and the building demolished. That event galvanized organizers and neighborhood groups in Chinatown, the Tenderloin, and others to push laws restricting SRO conversions. That's why today, on some of the most desirable real estate in the world, there are homes for people who often would otherwise be homeless. Let's meet one of those SRO residents now.
Hi, my name is Jeannie Vandegrift. I live at the Linane Hotel here in San Francisco. And I love living in San Francisco because it offers so much for seniors. And there's so much to do. And I'm very content living where I live. I was a foster parent for 11 years before I got an ulcer and I just couldn't do it anymore. It was the hardest I've ever worked in my life. But I felt that I made an immediate impact on society and what I did counted. And they all called me mom. Over 230. I ran a satellite home, taking them directly from a trauma situation into my home. My husband had been arrested for bank robbery, and we lost our house, our home, to foreclosure. And I think it's harder for a man than it is a woman. Because I told him, we got a place, we got a roof over our head, we got food on the table, we're together. The rest is just stuff. You know, we're together. But he had two mental breakdowns, flipped out, and robbed 5 banks. I went on drugs. I landed up on drugs. It was like a breakdown for both of us. I was bigger than I am now, and I kept stressing about my weight. And my daughter says, I can show you how to lose weight, but it's illegal. And I thought, well, I'm a product of the 60s. And that's how I was introduced to crank. You don't say to yourself, I'm gonna lose my teeth, I'm gonna lose my house, I'm gonna lose this, I'm gonna lose that, but I'm gonna be thin, which I did. I lost almost 100 pounds. Like I said, I was big. But I worked the whole time. I was a functioning addict. And because I didn't start till I was 47, I've gotten counseling over this. My morals and my standards were already set. So I didn't do a lot of things girls do for drugs. You know, I mean, I wasn't getting them for free, so I had to pay for them. So I maintained my dignity, and that was important to me. My oldest daughter, I told her she was arrested, and I said, you can come stay with me. Well, even the police said she was trying to strong arm me out of my own apartment. She turned, you know, I make a home. Wherever I live, I make my home. It's not a house. She turned it into a drug house, and we got evicted. She took off, and I'm sitting there watching myself all my stuff being loaded into a trailer, and I'm thinking, I just can't do this anymore. I can't. And I will be clean 8 years in October. My family, I've gained the respect back. My oldest one is the one who's a drug addict. My middle one quit before me. And my youngest one is clean over a year and a half now, and she said her new addiction is work. She just loves to work. She got herself a car. She's got registered, insured. And now she's got a second job. I hope that's not going to lead to burnout, you know? But it's just a 3 hours a night at a Dollar Tree. And I'm very proud of her. Nothing will jeopardize my sobriety. It's easy to quit methamphetamines. You just put us in a corner and we'll sleep it off. Staying off methamphetamines, just like any drug, you know? Staying off the drug. To this day, I battle, you know? I still get the craving, but I don't do it. Because I'm never going to let my life be like that again. I got a Macy's card. I've got a Michael Kors purse that was a gift, but it's elegant, elegant. And I have a Visa card. This is not where you want to die in a hotel like this, but you know what? I'm fine here.
That piece was produced by Colin Peden as part of a partnership with the city's Department of Supportive Housing. You can hear many more profiles every day this week right here on Cross Currents. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Earlier, we heard a little bit about the state of urban development in the late 1970s. Well, it was also a historic time for gay liberation in San Francisco. In 1978, the Briggs Initiative was defeated, which would have banned gays and lesbians from working in public schools. Harvey Milk became one of the first openly gay elected officials in the country. Milk was, of course, tragically killed in November of that year. But in June, he rode in the city's first Gay Freedom Day parade, now known as Pride, and gave his iconic Hope speech. It was also the year the San Francisco Lesbian Gay Freedom Band was born. Today, they're the official band of the city of San Francisco and one of the most beloved institutions in town. We spoke to a few members about what the band means to them.
All right, let's just do one scale, and then we are really going to move through a lot of music tonight.
I'm Pete Nallen, and I'm in my third season as the artistic director of the San Francisco Lesbian Gay Freedom Band. We will be celebrating our 40th anniversary in 2 years, and it was the first lesbian gay ensemble in the world, founded by John Sims, who looked at the situation of the developing gay rights movement and felt that the arts could be a vital component of that movement. So in 1978, he founded the Lesbian Gay Freedom Band, and shortly thereafter, the Gay Men's Chorus. And then you can see similar organizations sprouting all over the country.
John Sims, there is footage you can find if you look for it of a reporter running up to him in the parade, because he did lead the band in the parade. And said, "Excuse me, so what is your message?" And he kind of looked at her like, "What?" And just said, "Music. Our message is music." And then he just turned around and pranced off. My name is Billy Green. I play trombone in the band. I started with the band in 1991, in October of 1991. I moved here from North Carolina, and I stumbled across the band at the Folsom Street Fair, where they're always willing to take new members. And I haven't played my trombone for 10 years, and they said, like we always do, "That's fine, just come and try anyway."
My name is Sally Kanhuda, and I play in the percussion section. To me, it amazes me that I'm going to be 65 this year and that I'm still in a marching band. You know, that's pretty cool. Oh, my wife and I are both in the band. When we did get married, domestic partners, then that's when I really introduced her to the band, and I told her, I says, if you want to marry me, you're going to marry a band with it. You know, I've been in the band since 91, and I brought her in 93, and we did the Dreams concert. She was stage crew, and that's when she got the bug back in, and she confessed to me later that she really is a band geek, and that she did do woodwinds in grammar school and high school. So we went right down to Bronstein's and bought her first bass clarinet. It's just amazing when you go out onto the street, and usually it's pride. It's the pride parades that make it the big worthwhile the whole year round. Other parades are kind of different. I mean, I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but straight parades are, you know, with city parades, and they're different than pride. Pride is when you really step out, and you know, those people are all with you, and they understand where you're coming from and the work that you've done and to get to where you're at. And especially being older, the younger kids don't really realize how hard it was, you know.
The band got invited to play in the parade in Fresno. We went down this long, straight road, and it was just desolate. And there was, you know, we'd pass a house, and there'd be two people standing on the front porch looking at us and waving or hiding behind their curtains because the homosexuals are out there. And then when we got to the end, and that's where everybody was. And even more to the point, that's where the people in the parade in front of us were now, because they were done. They came back to watch the rest of the parade. And our drum major at the time, Frank Jones, got us to the intersection. And it was just on our side of the intersection, zero. On the other side of the intersection, hundreds of people standing there waiting for us. And he stopped us in the intersection. He had us play Basin Street Blues, which the arrangement we do starts out slowly and then speeds up, and when it speeds up, then we start marching. So we did this whole intro of like 16 or 32 bars, and then the tempo picked up and we stepped off, and I am not exaggerating at all when I tell you that when I stepped across that line on the other side of the intersection where the people were, they were screaming so loud I could not hear the music coming out of my own horn 3 inches away from my left ear. And it was so overwhelming, I very nearly burst into tears. It's hard to put in words what that means. I mean, it's acceptance, it's glad you're here.
I hate the word tolerant. I don't want to be tolerated. I want to be appreciated. I want to be celebrated. I want to just be. The network of people is just so incredible, and you feel that every moment. It's such a welcoming organization. We've grown a lot in the last 2 years. We have a lot of young people. So now we have also this new energy coming into the group that's really exciting. And music is such a great way to merge and bridge the differences that come with age and other differences, that we end up with just such a tightly knit, wonderful group of people who really know each other. Often when you lead a group, they come and play and they go home, and maybe they know the four people they sit next to. And that is definitely not the case with this organization. It's a group of friends.
That piece was produced by Jen Chien. You can catch the San Francisco Lesbian Gay Freedom Band this weekend at their 31st annual Dance Along Nutcracker. The show is at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. It's great for the whole family, and be warned, it's all about audience participation. Find all the details on our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. Our team today includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Strempel, and Beatrice Thomas. The show is engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the local band Never Young. You can catch them at the Swedish American Hall in San Francisco Thursday night. Things start around 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.